first half, second half, it's like chalk and cheese.
That can't be my best bet, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together. Putting the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. It is Wednesday, July 24th, 2019. We are officially done with the first round of the League's Cup. My good friend, Rabbi Mark Goodman, it's been a bad week for a lot of people involved and who care about Rapids land.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. It's only been a bad week for me. Everybody else has had a pretty good week. Me and Sebastian. Me and Sebi, as Cello likes to call him. But yeah, it's been interesting. I was just thinking, you know, it was easier to define myself as a sports writer, and because the word sports podcaster is both lame and too long. There's just a lot of syllables in sports podcaster. Plus, you know, being a soccer writer in America is pretty low on the totem pole of respect. Once you say like, well, I used to write about soccer, but then they fired me, so now I just podcast about soccer. Like, that's, you know, no offense if you're a fellow soccer podcasters, or Matt, if you actually define yourself primarily when you go up to girls at bars as I'm a soccer podcaster. But like, that's pathetic. Like, that's like, you know, I mean, there's just no way around the fact that like being a quote unquote soccer podcaster is like, you know, you're better off as just a season ticket holder or like a member of C38. Like, that might get you a girl at a bar, but like, oh, I podcast about soccer. That's, you know, that girl is probably, you'd be lucky if she threw a drink in your face. That would be a step up from what she ought to do, which is just like, you know, snuff out a cigarette on your, you know, on your forehead and move on.
If that she's would got be- a cigarette or she's vaping, Mark, she is definitely not my type, but that's an interesting one for me to pull. I actually remember, I don't know if this was ever actually verified, but somebody reported when Harrison Shipp, midfielder for Seattle Sounders, was at Chicago Fire, his first MLS club, when he was there, I think somebody reported that, like, when he was out socializing and everything, he would introduce himself. He got a finance degree, I want to say, from the University of Notre Dame, and then he was doing, like, an internship during the off-season, and he would introduce himself as, like, a, you know, I've majored in finance, like, I'm trying to get into finance. Like, he, as a professional soccer player, would not introduce himself to new people as like, oh, I play for the Chicago Fire in the city of Chicago. How do you think that works out, Mark? This is a really dangerous question, but like Cole Bassett, for example, or, you know, Sam Vines, who's 20 years old right now, like if he's just hanging out at like Dave and Buster's or like something and like he meets somebody, like do they introduce themselves and it's like, oh, what do you do? Or, oh, are you going to college? Like, do you say, oh, I play for the Colorado Rapids?
Somebody, who was it who told me last year that Eric Miller picked them up in his car for an Uber ride from the airport? Like, Eric Miller.
Oh,
was
my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, you know, part of that is that, you know, the Major League minimum 2 years ago and 3 years ago was unbelievably low. I mean, it's still pretty low, but it was like, just 5 years ago, the minimum of Major League Soccer was like $36,000. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's up to 57.
It's like, so just under 60 pre-tax.
You don't really, the other thing is like these guys, you know, not to poo-poo it, but like they work out for 2.5-3 hours a day and then their bodies have to recover. So they have a lot of free time. It's not like, it's not a 9-to-5 being a soccer player. You know, your body has to recover. You get a couple days off a week. It's a pretty cush gig. The one thing that I've always been shocked at is that that Major League Soccer players don't have more expected appearances in their contract. Like there's a standard CBA, required, appearances. And then after that, they got to pay them extra. And since the Colorado Rapids like to pinch a penny here and there, they never go over the minimum. It's like, you know, you're going to play You're just gonna show up for your three minimum appearances, and that's that.
One of whom is probably the season ticket holder, meet the team party, probably. But yeah, Mark, did you want to address anything on your outlets?
Yeah. We're what, like, you know, 5 minutes into the podcast, and for those of you who are not aware, you can now quit your subscription to the Denver Post, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, found out the hard way, you can't quit online. You have to call somebody. You literally have to use the phone. So I'm going to have to do that. Like, I haven't even canceled my subscription. Yes, I was a subscriber so I could read my own stuff. But yeah, the Denver Post decided that there wasn't enough readership for my column, Backpass, and so they axed it last week. So, womp womp. But you know what? I want to thread the needle here between, and I'll say it out loud, which is like, and I was going to say this off pod before we started, but, I want to thread the needle between, you know, using this as an opportunity to dump on the Denver Post, but also thanking the Denver Post for giving me a shot in the first place. But I'm going to do both. So, and I think that that's a fun exercise in either diplomacy or complete and utter stupidity on my part. So the positive is this: Daniel Boniface, who is the digital editor, former sports editor, former Colorado Rapids beat writer, really liked my writing and said, I want to try this experiment and see if we can bring you on. I think the idea from the Denver Post was twofold. It was, I'm really showing you the cards of the institution. This might not be a good idea if I ever wanted to work for a newspaper ever again, but I don't think I'm ever working for a newspaper again, so I'm not worried. But they really wanted to, the idea was this, you know, there's gotta be a market for a kind of Huffington Post style of journalism, at the Denver Post, which is get people to write, get more clicks, expand the number of writers, and see if that's a market and that's a way to grow the newspaper. So that was, I think, part of the idea. The other part of the idea is this. I got paid a flat fee that was, you know, not nothing, but not a lot either, to write my articles. And then the hope was that I would get a kind of a bonus for everybody who subscribed, plus a tiny bonus for clicks. And the idea, I think, from the Denver Post was if Backpass and Soccer Rabbi can bring in, you know, 10 new subscribers a month, and then we kick them a little bonus, that's more than making our money for us, because each subscription is, you know, $13 a month. You know, that's $130 a month. That's more than worth it for this guy. But they didn't get 10 new subscribers a month. They get a whole bunch the first month, and then it kind of petered out after that. And so their contention was essentially, well, you're not making us enough money, or you're not making your salary right off the top. You're not just absolute, you know, whipped cream value added for us. And the quick response to that is, yeah, well, I'm on your sports writing staff. You know, you get 100,000 subscribers a month, some of whom click on my articles, and therefore I'm getting a piece of everybody who subscribes. I'm worthy of the advertising revenue you generate, you know? You're already a newspaper that's making a profit. Another way to spin that, if I wanted to be really Machiavellian, is over the last 10 years, the Denver Post's newsroom went from 300 writers to 75. I'm just a part-time writer who's covering the beat for one of these guys you fired because you were trying to save money. So don't look at me and say I'm not making you enough money. You know, I'm making you money. Be happy. My piddly little salary should be enough for you. But, and the last thing I'll say, now that I'm full-blown venting, because again, I want to say, they gave me a shot. It was a huge benefit. I'm really glad that I get to put this on my resume for the rest of my life. And, you know, it was an experiment, and it didn't work out, and that's cool. But the other way to look at it is, you know, long-term, short-term. And it's, I think, the same, and this is a good place to finish, but it's the same for the Colorado Rapids, or any sports team or any business, which is, if you're just in it for the short run, if you're just trying to, like, maximize profit right now, that's a terrible business model. It's a terrible way to run any organization. You know, it's one of the pitfalls of the U.S. government is that, like, politicians are often trying to do the thing that looks really popular right now, but like, how's it going to look down the line, right? Oh, I'm going to tell my constituents I'm going to cut taxes. And it doesn't matter that, you know, the grandchildren are going to have to pay off the national debt at a huge rate. Like, I'm going to be popular right now, like long-term, short-term. So I think that's the thing with the Denver Post, which is that they don't really know whether they should commit to putting in any energy on, you know, long-term writing for Major League Soccer, whether they should promote the Colorado Rapids and grow the readership and grow the fan base. Instead, they hired me for 6 months and then they said, all right, you know, like, we didn't make a ton of money off you, and so we're going to close it down. It's like they didn't wait long enough, in my humble opinion. Got to take time to grow these things. But hey, what the hell do I know?
Well said, Mark. My condolences, and I pour one out for you given the circumstances that have befallen you and a lot of other people in this ecosystem that we have a lot of respect for that, you know, have just had shaking, you know, stuff shaking up, whether they were writing for a newspaper or, you know, the recent overhaul that I think there was some good, some bad. In terms of what happened, at The Athletic, for example, I think this was Vox. It might have been another major outlet, but it was a couple of different contributors who just sort of contributed to like an article that was looking at just the future of journalism in the online space and the fact that everything is changing so much with how ad revenue works and everything that, you know, that's just very, very different from, you know, even the older writers, you know, at the Denver Post, for example, John Meyer, for example, a former colleague, you know, who covered the Rapids, who I think, you know, Mark, you and I both have a tremendous respect for. You know, the newspaper business that he joined in, and I don't know how old John is, but he's old enough that he has a daughter in college, I believe. So, you know, that extrapolates how old he was. You know, the newspaper business that he got into after finishing his bachelor's degree in journalism is so far different from the field of journalism when the dot-com boom happened, and is way different from what's happening now in 2019 going into 2020. And so as newspaper companies go about changing their structure and everything, I think that's created a lot of turbulence. And unfortunately, in a lot of these spaces, whether it's the BuzzFeeds of the world and everything, unfortunately, a lot of what drives things is can you get clicks or can you produce content to where people are buying stuff and to where people are buying a subscription or giving you money or Patreon or what have you. And one of the things that they pointed out is either that they point that this article, I believe from Vox, was pointing out is either the revenue streams for online journalism is going to have to change fundamentally, or writers are going to have to be far more careful and deliberate about the kind of stuff that they read. If you are tired of clickbaity ads and everything just being about single quotes and just stuff that has absolute no content or no value, or, you know, is the which Harry Potter house are you kind of stuff, then you need to actively not click at that stuff, and you need to actively go out and find the stuff that you find value in and read that. Scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, and if that's from an outlet that is consistently producing that content, then at least under the current model, unfortunately, if you want to keep that going, you have to partially be part of the crowdfunding that is sustaining that entity. And I don't have a good answer for you as to what you could have done differently, Mark. I don't think this is an indictment of your quality or even the structure of the Denver Post. Unfortunately, there's just the significant population of the people who are going to the Denver Post for stuff aren't going there for Rapids coverage. And I think there are a lot of other entities that unfortunately, you know, should, you know, have that finger pointed at before they're pointed at you. You know, one thing that I talked about this was back in undergrad. I was in the marching band in undergrad, and we were talking about what we could do to recruit more people from the freshman class. And we were having a big leadership meeting of all the section leaders and our drum majors and captains and everything. And at one point, our band director just threw his hands up and said, you know, unfortunately, the biggest recruiter for whether or not people want to be in marching band is how good the football team's doing. And unfortunately, and we've seen this in our own coverage, Mark, of whether or not people want to read about the Rapids is, are the Rapids good? Are they doing anything fun? Do they have any big players that, you know, the pleb sports fan in Denver knows about? And unfortunately, that hasn't happened since 2016.
Well, and I'll say three things real quick off that. One of them is, and I'm taking out the bat now a little bit, but one of the things that I've thought of, you know, one of the things that's interesting in sports writing for any sports writer is we are beholden to a good story And one of the facilitators of a good story is a good department of communications or director of communications. And it's really valuable to be able to, I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, you know, it was really, we come up with ideas. I have to come up with an idea for my column every week, right? What's my angle? What's the thing? What's interesting? Or I want to interview a player. And so I got to figure out like, who's an interview that's a good interview. And you find out who's a good interview and who's got a good story by doing a lot of interviews and getting a lot of bad stories. It's a lot easier for a director of communications to call you up and be like, yo, I'm going to pitch you a story. You're going to want to write it. It's a really good one. So a couple of years ago, the U.S. Women's National Team sent out a thing saying like, hey, we're going to do a media day just for Mallory Pugh and Lindsey Horan. Come on down and ask any questions you want. And I came down and I asked questions, and it was an article that wrote itself, like, you know, local girl makes good, like local girls make good. It was an easy story. These two women were from Colorado. They grew up in Denver, and it was a natural. It was the easiest thing in the world. That story only happened because a director of communications was smart enough to say, this is a story that I can pitch at a bunch of writers and they'll all write it. We don't have
and
that.
And put in the legwork to create the environment such that stuff writes itself.
It shows the value of a good media and communications department. We don't have that in Colorado right now. The Rapids don't have a director of communications. And so nobody and by the way, in my entire 6 years of writing on the Colorado Rapids, nobody ever did that. Nobody from the Rapids ever called me up and said, you know who'd be a really good story for you is so-and-so. The only version of that is with the homegrowns. They did a good job of promoting their homegrowns. So props to the Rapids on that. And they did a pretty good job promoting their DPs when they came in of saying like, hey, let's have a big press conference. This is a big deal. But I never got pitched on the story. So that's thing one. Thing two I was going to say had to do with the struggle of the clickbaity model and the Denver Post. The Denver Post editors who did a good job of my articles, but they never knew what the hell to do with me, to be honest, Matt. Like they would put a new title on the article on Backpass. Like I used to use a quote from Star Trek or you know, a song lyric as my title. And they would always take a line out of context and put a question mark on it. Is Connor Casey a genius? You know, are the Rapids going to win another game this season? It's like, I didn't write those titles at all. Somebody else did. And I would get hammered on Reddit. Like people on Reddit would be like, the Denver Post is trash, or, you know, this writer is an idiot.
Writing clickbaity stuff. Why is he just doing this stuff with having grown the headline and brrr?
I wrote the same stuff I've written for 6 years of tactical analysis and deep dives and pontificating and wondering about the overall structure of Major League Soccer or the CBA coming up next or whatever. And the editors would throw a clickbait title on there. And some people would like it and some people wouldn't. So, you know, that's just the way the beast works.
Was that the third thing, Mark, or was there another thing?
That was the second, and I can't remember what the third one was. I had another idea about a thing, but, you know, it definitely had to do with, you know, oh, I remember there was, you're right. Very good. The last thing I'll say is I've had a couple people say politely, like, oh, you know, keep writing. You'll find someone to pay for it soon. And I will probably write more. I don't know when and I don't know what. I'll keep writing on the Pittsburgh site, but, I don't think people fully understand the time commitment that the writing takes. Leaving aside an interview where you have to call somebody up and interview them and then transcribe the interview. When I did Backpass every week, it typically took me about 8 hours of work, 2 hours to watch the game originally, 2 hours to watch the game a second time and either create GIFs off of it or just write down ideas I had or something like that. And then 2 to 4 hours of writing, and, you know, and maybe also editing. So that's 8 hours a week, to churn out the content. You know, and sometimes like, and back in the day before I got paid for the post, like I could bust off a Backpass and I would do it out of the pure love of the game, but it's definitely a little bit harder once you've been paid a little bit for it and then you're not. So I will probably write again. I will probably write for free. But I do want people to understand that like, you don't just kind of like work for free for 8 hours a week for nothing.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you, Mark. You know, I'd say independent of actually watching the game, I would just say actual preparation and material for this podcast, the recording of it, and then the post-editing, and then the social afterward between you and me. That's probably easily 8 hours between the two of us. And so, you know, on that note.
Mostly you, though. Absolutely. Mostly you. Matt does all the editing. So props to Matt.
Well, this worked out great when, like, we would record in your basement, and so I'd come over to your house, and, like, you'd have food and snackage and beer, then it was even, and now it's a little bit more uneven. But in any case, speaking of things being uneven at the end of the day, Mark, the Colorado Rapids were defeated by NYCFC this past Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. The final score was 2-1. NYCFC comes out and has a lot of possession, but not much chance creation, very little possession with a purpose, if you will. And then in the 6th minute, Jonathan Lewis picks off a pass and runs the length, well, I'd say center midfield, all the way through to the end of the touchline, sends a cross in, and the goal is credited to Sebastian Anderson, his first goal professionally in Major League Soccer. I've seen a couple replays, Mark, where I kind of wonder if Matarita got a touch on it, was it before or after Seb Anderson. In any case, the box score still says that Sebastian Anderson has the goal. NYCFC continues to possess the ball, and then all you know what completely goes down the drain in the 33rd minute, Mark. Matarita has the ball on the far sideline. Sebastian Anderson is going to make a challenge for, misses on the ball, kind of falls backwards a little bit, and then goes with his studs up to the upper leg, maybe lower part of the knee of Matarita. Chris Penso immediately reaches for the back pocket, and Sebastian Anderson is given his first goal and his first red card as a professional soccer player, all within the span of less than a half hour. Then you have a Bears score 5 minutes before halftime, on a nice volley off the chest, off a cross by Maxi Morales. Tommy Smith pulled out of position in that. A couple of minutes later, it appears that Tim Howard strains his calf, his right calf, and is subbed out right on the brink of halftime for Clint Irwin. Then the second half is your pretty typical, the Rapids being a defensive team and not having the ball and also being down a man, Mark. Sam Nicholson comes in, and they have a couple good counterattack opportunities. Ultimately, it is Alexandru Mitrita who scores in the 83rd minute. We'll talk about that goal in a little bit, on a long cross that Lalas Abubakar heads down. Nicholson with a couple of exchanges in there with Emigara, the center back for NYCFC, one of which was right on the edge, maybe on the line of the penalty area, not called, and then one just outside the penalty area that was called, and Emigara was given a yellow card. You had Keegan Rosenberry miss an opportunity off of a set piece in the final minutes, and ultimately the game ends by a score of 2-1. Another game in which the Rapids lose at home to an Eastern Conference opponent, and another game in which the Rapids lose having given up a red card at home. Mark, I'll throw it to you. What was your good thing from this match?
I thought the Rapids looked decent against a team that is one of the better sides in MLS, so I think that's always an important thing to point out. I think I said that they were going to lose 2-0, and they only lost 2-1. So that's my good thing. Is the other thing is that that's a good thing is that I actually got a prediction right for once. The other time I got trashed on Reddit and Twitter was when I predicted that the Rapids would take the L against LAFC, and they actually won. Like I said, I don't like predicting, but you know, I think. To say that they lost but looked better than I thought they were gonna against a very good MLS side is damning by faint praise. I think that Jonathan Lewis keeps showing up is another way of looking at this. I think you said it well by saying that Matarita probably scored on his own goal, but I'm happy that Sebastian Anderson got accredited to him. But the reality was that goal was completely created by Jonathan Lewis, especially the way he looped that ball in and over and in front. He's just been a delight to watch, and he's been really, you know, on fire for the Rapids up till now. What was your good thing, Matt?
You had Sam Nicholson again be a really competent super sub. There's been some questions hurled at me on Twitter about why isn't he starting, and I've still heard a couple rumblings that maybe they're being a little bit more cautious with that hamstring, especially when, you know, Anthony Hudson really pushed Sam Nicholson when he was dealing with the back issue, when it was something that they had managed, but it was something they had to be aware of, and then he pulls up in the game at LAFC, so I think they're being a little bit more cautious with him. And then Jack Price stepping in, you know, the foot appears to be okay. okay, and all things considered, given, you know, playing almost 60 minutes down a man and everything, I thought he did okay. No Kai Kamara, that was a little bit problematic, but, you know, Andre Shinyashiki back in his natural position, you know, as a solo forward up top, I thought had some good moments. I just, you know, kind of like the New England game a couple weeks ago, it's really hard for me to truly analyze this game because after the 33rd right. minute, it was so weird that, you know, how many other times the rest of the year are the Rapids going to be at home and up a goal but down a man? Are we really gleaming anything in terms of the tactical decisions or the substitutions or anything? Like, we can pull out individual moments of individual mistakes and anything, but, like, I'm not judging this team for the shot difference or possession or anything being down a man. You know, if anything, I'd echo your point that I think no matter what the circumstances are, I think Jonathan Lewis is absolutely the straw that stirs the drink from a white side, from a wide standpoint. You know, I think if there's no red card to Sebastian Anderson and Kai Kamara is in here, I think we're having a very different conversation. I guess on that note, Mark, where do you want to start with bad stuff?
I mean, you said it really well, which is the 33rd minute red card changes everything. And it's one of those things where if you're – and I know that I've seen this conversation elsewhere. I don't know if we've had it, but I think I heard this conversation on an extra time radio a couple of years ago. If you're watching a neutral game, a neutral English Premier League game where you're not a fan of either team – a neutral MLS game, a neutral game of any kind, and a red card happens, especially early in the game, I am inclined personally to turn it off.
Yep.
Like, we live in a world where there's, and this is an insane thing to say, considering 10 years ago you were lucky to be able to find one soccer game a weekend that you could watch on TV. But we live in a world now where you can stream any one of probably a dozen soccer matches almost at any given time, right? When we hit that sweet spot where MLS and Europe are overlapping in August, September, and October, you could wake up on a Saturday morning at 3 o'clock in the morning and catch a Chinese game, take a quick cat nap, and then
start a Premier League at 5 a.m. Right. Mountain.
Yeah, and watch that game. And then at the 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and 11 o'clock slots, you can watch any one of three or four different games in three or four different leagues. And you can pretty much do that all the way till the end of Sunday. And it's insane. So you don't have to sit through watching one team bunker and hang on for dear life with having gone down to 10 men. Like, you don't have to do that. So with the Rapids, you're watching them go down to 10 men at the 33rd minute, and you're thinking to yourself, like, they're not going to win this match. Maybe they hold on and draw this match. And for a while, they looked like they would. You know, they gave up the goal in the 40th minute, and then they gave up the go-ahead goal in the 83rd. But for a while, you know, from 45 to 83, they really looked not great, like they were hanging on for dear life. But after the 75th minute, you start to think to yourself, like, they look terrible. They're getting pounded. Everybody's, you know, they're, you know, New York has the ball the whole time and they're shooting on them. But maybe they pull this out. Maybe this is just one of those magical games. And finally the dam broke and that was that. But that's the bad thing is that, you know, Sebi had the red. You know, you kind of feel for him because he cost the team 3 points. But on the other hand, what the hell was he doing starting at right wing anyways? I mean, like, there's just it's kind of a strange match all around for that reason. You know, we also had, Danny Wilson playing at the defensive mid again alongside Jack Price. Kai Kamara out with, I think it was listed as a back problem, Matt.
That's my understanding as well.
And so you get, Andre Shinyashiki, who, is a very different striker. I think Shinyashiki's been most valuable as a sub, for Kai Kamara, particularly because Kamara, is such a different striker. You know, he wants to head the ball. He's so physical. He's so good, back to goal. And Shinyashiki's going to go through the lines. He's going to attack. He's dribbly. He comes at angles, which is something Kamara doesn't necessarily do. The other thing is that Shinyashiki is pretty good with Kamara on the field at the same time, or with Jonathan Lewis. And here he didn't have Kamara to kind of work off of. So there's a lot of that. You know, I think that, you know, the red card's really important. To note, everything after that is kind of window dressing. Matt, your thought on the bad thing?
I don't know that I want to go to bad thing necessarily, but I think it would be a useful exercise for us to break down a couple of really key officiating decisions, especially since I was the pool reporter for this game at DSG Park, so I got to answer two pool reporter questions of Chris Penso and his staff. So I guess let's start chronologically, Mark. We already touched on it a little bit, but the red card to Sebastian Anderson that I think you and I were pretty even on. There were some, I'd say, differing opinions from the 15,000 plus reported people who were at DSG on Saturday, and I was fending off a lot of people on Twitter as well. But so I asked the question, let's go through the pool reporter responses here, Mark. Listeners, I am reading this word for word verbatim as I reported it and as I got the answers back from Chris Penso's staff. What was the primary reasons for the red card to Sebastian Anderson? And then I kind of listed in parentheses point of contact, level of force, studs up, etc. And the response I got back was Anderson committed a tackle that endangered the safety of his opponent using a straight leg and coming over the top of the ball with his studs making contact above the opponent's ankle. From what I saw, it was anywhere from, it was definitely above where the shin guards were on Materia, but I would say maybe top of Sebastian Anderson's toe was probably right at the base of Matarita's knee, and then all the way down to maybe, you know, the top third of Matarita's leg. So I'm getting some banter back and forth on Twitter on this one, Mark, and on every single one I responded, it was studs up, he didn't get the ball, he went in with force, and it was an area that he wasn't protected, i.e. where the boot or the shin guard was protecting him. For me, those three things quantify absolutely, and Chris Penso's agrees, endangering the safety of the opponent. Is there any real disagreement that we have on here with the decision and the reasoning behind the decision?
No, I think you said it well. I think I agree with Chris Penso. He's a ref I generally respect and agree with, to be honest. I mean, I find him to be a no-nonsense guy. I kind of like the guy where, you know, when refs get argued with by players, you look at their face and they have this look on their face like, would you stop with your BS? Like, I'm not changing my yellow card back, and you know, I'm not changing the yellow card back. Right now you're just being whiny. I always respect that about Penso. I think he generally gets it right. He commands a pretty good game. I thought Anderson didn't make a smart challenge there, and it was probably dangerous.
Okay, let's move on to the second goal for New York City FC. That was unassisted to Matrita in the 83rd minute. Matrita was a sub. And on the initial play, Mark, the ball is played from the NYCFC defensive half by Maxi Morales. Hebert and Matarita, you know, who's kind of he's the heel or the nemesis of the Rapids in this game, drawing the red card and then now being involved in this, are roughly marking, even with the center backs, Tommy Smith and Lala Abubakar on the cross. There was a question about whether or not Matarita and potentially Matrita, who's in a wide role and not involved in the play until the goal, whether or not they were offside. Tommy Smith was the last defender on here. Ultimately, the ball goes towards Matarita and Lala Abubakar. Matarita does not make a challenge for it. He's a little bit ahead of the ball, and Lala Abubakar just heads it down, I assume looking for a Danny Wilson or Jack Price in the middle of the box, in the middle of the field, to clean it up. Nobody steps to the ball, and nobody else is there. Matrita is able to run onto it and then slot it into the bottom corner past Clint Irwin. So, and I heard there were a number of Rapids officials who were very, very upset about this. I heard some, we'll call it choice language, in the hallways on the north side of DSG in the building, about that overall decision. This gets into a really hairy place for me, Mark. One, I haven't seen a really good angle that absolutely shows it for sure in terms of that. I'm set up, folks, in the press box almost, you know, right at the center circle, so to speak. I did not see the actual sequence live, so I can't speak to that, but none of the replays in the stadium were that good, and the only good one that we actually saw was one of the ESPN Plus cameras that was actually used by Bobby Warshaw on this week's iteration of Instant Replay to review the play, Mark. And even then, still, there's not really an even angle. You know, it looks like it might be, but, you know, just based on how the angle of the shot is and when you actually get the shot, it looks like Tommy Smith is the last one back prior to Clint Irwin. And so for that, for me, that's onside. And then even then, this would be a play of indirect offsides, folks. Obviously, Matrita doesn't make an initial play on the ball. And by the time Lalas heads down, that's a new play. So he's not offsides. But then there's the question of indirect offsides, folks. You see this a lot in instances where, say, you have an offensive player who's in an offsides position and obstructing the view of the goalkeeper. Or maybe a player takes a shot to where the goalkeeper has to judge whether or not it's a play to that player who's in an offsides role, whether or not that happens, but no NYCFC player actually touches it on the play that is in question for offside. So in that, you have to judge at that point that one, Matrita was offside, then we don't have any video evidence for, and then two, you have to judge that Matrita's positioning was enough that it forced Abubakar to play the header only where he could. This, for me, folks, is one of the most subjective calls that you have in the overall laws of the game. For those reasons, I agree with the decision, and while it is many things, while it is questionable, while it would be nice if we had another video angle that absolutely showed whether or not the play was offsides, the one thing that for me it is absolutely not is clear and obvious. It is everything but, and for those reasons, I think, you know, if this was an NFL play, I would say after video review, the call on the field stands. Good goal.
Yep. Yeah, I had a lot of questions about that goal too. It really did look like it was manifestly offside, but I think your points about attempting to play the ball are there. And I also think, you know, going back, way back, you know, to, Abubakar trying to clear the ball, you know, on that second goal, it's not a great clearance, and that happens sometimes. You know, that's one of those things I think is an undervalued skill in both goalkeepers and in center backs and fullbacks too. But, the ability not only to get to a ball and get a clearance on a ball, but really clear that ball away. And I think it's a thing, you know, I've been critical of Tim Howard on at least a couple of occasions over the last couple of years where, he got to the ball. Yeah, he blocked the ball, but he really needed a punch because, you know, there were players at the edge of the box, if he cleared it, with a tap, that were going to just put it right back. And it's not fair because it's a very hard thing to do. It's like, oh, he made a save, but his save wasn't good enough to keep from letting a second effort come back in. But it's the difference between great and amazing, or good and great. And that's the same thing with Abubakar. It's like, you know, lots of center backs are going to clear the ball. Is a center back going to clear the ball out of the box in a way that really accomplishes the best possible result? And I think those are the elite skills of your top level athletes. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to figure out how to be a better player, you're trying to figure out not like, can I get to that ball? But like, when I get to that ball, what am I going to do with it? It's a thing that I work with the kids at this low level of like, when I'm coaching U10s of like, U8s, and so on, where it's not just, great job kicking the ball, but like when you kicked the ball, did you just wind up and hit it as hard as you could? Did you have a plan of where you were kicking it? You know, what are you going to do with that ball? Thinking before you get to it. And, you know, at a high, high level, it's, you know, approaching that ball and being able to do with it what you will, at the moment that it comes to you.
Absolutely, Mark. And, you know, that's something that if Abubakar does it, then I think, you know, like fans are immediately giving a cheer, possibly going to their feet. And, you know, here we're reviewing it as probably one of the good things we have from the game. But that's something that I'd say probably 3 to 4 times in a single match, we would expect a Virgil van Dijk to do for Liverpool. And I think that just speaks to the level of speed of play and anticipation that I think shows where MLS still has some catching up to do with regard to the, you know, world-class leagues and world-class players in soccer. And then let's go kind of chronologically, just generally the Sam Nicholson in an attacking position, and is he impeded by a player for NYCFC? I asked specifically about the one that there wasn't any contact on, Mark, but we'll talk about this just as a concept in general. So on the pool reporter question, folks. The other question that I had was, in the play involving Sam Nicholson and Sebastian Ibega, contact at the edge of the box that was not called a foul, so differentiating it from the other ones, what was the reason behind the decision? And so the response I got was, the amount of contact was not deemed to be a foul consistent with the other decisions throughout the match. I've gone back and looked at the replay a couple of times, Mark, and neither official really has a good view. Whatever contact is or isn't happening over the back, possibly Ibega, you know, clipping the back leg of Sam Nicholson, that's at an angle to where Sam Nicholson's body is blocking things for the sideline official, the assistant referee who's on the near side, and then Ibega's back is directly if you draw a line out of Ibega's back, that's directly where Chris Penso is. So I don't know that either of anybody really had a good view on the actual contact. On a few of the replays that I've looked at on any of the sequences where there's some question, there isn't really a good camera angle. So again, I think we kind of have to lean towards giving the official the benefit of the doubt, just because there's not video evidence that suggests otherwise. But this is a concept that I think generally exists, that, you know, we've seen a little bit more in soccer. You can look at Carlos Vela in El Tráfico over the weekend, for example, where it's late in the match, players are desperate, and, you know, they're just doing anything they can do to try and draw a call in that situation. And in some players doing that, refs have to call it as if they're being, you know, as if they're suspicious of everybody. Not saying that Sam Nicholson dove on that sequence or any one, but just the specter of that is what is expected in the game, therefore the officials are going to correct, and then sometimes, you know, a player doesn't get the benefit of the doubt in a situation that normally you would say is absolutely a foul, just because how everybody else is playing the game theory. Your thoughts on that individual sequence and just that concept in general?
Yeah, I'm going to just completely go with your side and not belabor it too much. Yeah, I think you said it well.
Okay, so I guess on that note, Mark, like, was there any critical referee decision that you saw at all in this match that you have real gripes about as far as, like, reviewing either procedural or personnel decisions as it relates to, you know, we've had this in other games. For the Rapids, where we've had real issues with how the rules were being interpreted or them being inconsistent, you know, with how the rest of the league was calling things or how an individual ref would call them in other games or how other teams would be called in them, whether it was a procedure with VAR or certainly, you know, ball to hand versus handball being called. Like, was there anything really in there that you saw that, like, you're up in arms about that you'd really like to sit down and hash things out with Howard Webb over at Pro?
I wasn't. I mean, I acknowledge, you know, maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention, but I acknowledge that every once in a while you're going to have a game that has a lot of close calls. Sometimes you're going to have a game that just has a lot of physicality and a lot of violence. And sometimes you're going to have a game that's like this, where there's a bunch of, like, moments where the ref either has to swallow their whistle and it's a hard thing to do, or the ref has to blow their whistle in a difficult situation and in a game-changing decision. And I just didn't think that – I think there were a lot of decisions for Chris Penso to make, but I didn't disagree with any of them, to be honest. And that's not always the case. There are times when I watch the referees be too active or not active enough and I throw up my hands. This was just a game where I was like, yeah, there were a lot of decisions to make. The referees generally made them, and the game played out as it was. I don't think you can – I am also generally not someone who thinks the game is won or lost by the referees. When you allow the opponent to have 29 shots on goal, you're going to lose. There's just no way about it. It's amazing they only lost 2-1, considering. When you get peppered with that many shots – And specifically, a lot of those shots were, within the 18-yard box. Like, you're going to lose. So I don't think it behooves us to try and pin this on the refs. That's a thing that fans like to do, and there's nothing wrong with that, to say, like, the game would have been totally different if. But, like, the reality is we were outplayed, and the red card was correct, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Well said, Mark. I guess on that note, guess who is reffing this week's Colorado Rapids game?
Oh, my God. When you say that, there's only one name that comes to mind, although there's a second possibility. Is it Baldomero Toledo?
It is Baldomero Toledo.
Oh, man, no.
Team Chaos! Alright, we've got a great segment of Know Thy Enemy, Mark, but first let me just read the stats for the sake of completeness. Listeners, we are currently 21-34 through the Colorado Rapids 2019 season. They're sitting tied with Vancouver on points, but are ahead on goal differential, so 11th in the Western Conference with 20 points on those 21 games played. They have a palindrome score, record of 5-11-5 with a negative 10 goal difference. This week they'll be playing San Jose Earthquakes at Avaya Stadium on Saturday. San Jose Earthquakes are 5th in the Western Conference. They've got 34 points off of 21 games played. 10-7-4 is their record, and they've got a plus 4 goal differential. San Jose at home this year, 7-3-1. Their first three home games they lost, Mark, so they're 7-0-1 since then. And the Colorado Rapids are 1-5-3 away from DSG Park this year. Really quickly, before we go to Know Thy Enemy, Mark, any thoughts that you have on this match?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're going to hear about it. I'm looking forward to hearing this interview after it's posted also. But the key to San Jose is Matias Almeida's man marking system. And the concept that, not only is it a good system just by itself, but the fact that nobody else in Major League Soccer does this thing called man marking, which is basically, matching up one-on-one all over the field defensively, and following your guy all around. It's a thing, you know, you hear all about in basketball, man-to-man defense, but in soccer, it's not done. Nobody does it. And, you know, Almeida is the savant of this. The thing that makes it, other than the fact that it's just an effective defense, so effective, is that it's just different than everybody else. Nobody else does this, and so if you're Connor Casey, you're trying to get the Rapids ready for it, but you only have, you know, roughly 4 days, 5 days of practice to get them ready for it, and it's not enough time to kind of fully shift their brains over to this system. So that's a thing to worry about, and with the Rapids, it's a major disadvantage for them coming into this game.
With that, listeners, let's head over to Know Thy Enemy, where I speak with Joel Soria, the editor-in-chief of Epicenter and a contributor to Black and Azul on the YouTube. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name's Matt Pollard. Right now, we've got a special segment of Know Thy Enemy for you, bringing on Joel Soria at Soria Joel Football on Twitter. He is the editor-in-chief of Quakes Epicenter. He's a regular host on Black and Azul, a San Jose Earthquakes-themed YouTube channel. And full disclosure, once upon a time, Joel was one of the contributors to Last Word on Soccer, and I was his editor. Joel, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, Matt. It's a pleasure to talk to you once again, and thank you so much for getting me on the show. How are you?
Oh my God. Our guests never asked me how I'm doing. I'm doing very good. Thank you. You know, it is very, very hot here in Denver, Colorado. I'm going to assume that it's hotter in the general Bay Area, so I don't have room to, complain about that, but been getting some hiking going on. And well, the Rapids haven't been great the last three games, but the games have all been very exciting. So from a writer standpoint, I always have a story to write about. So that's not anything to complain about. And I guess on that note, Joel, since we're talking about the San Jose Earthquakes, what are your thoughts on the recent game, a 3-1 victory for the Quakes against the Vancouver Whitecaps?
A complete performance yet again from the Quakes. Obviously not stellar given the fact that, you know, the Whitecaps were able to get on the board early on from the set piece play, which I think is going to be the Rapids tool come Saturday. I think they need to manage that. The Quakes do. And the Rapids need to use that to their advantage. But we can talk about that moving forward in a little bit. But, yeah, going back to that game against the Caps in Vancouver, you know, the Quakes demonstrated not only to the Caps but to the entire league that they're a legitimate team. You know, Matias Almeida at the moment has what I think is the most sophisticated style in the league, the most sophisticated scheme, thought-provoking. It's played with pace. It's direct. It's attack-oriented and a bit peculiar. You know, it's not something that you see on this side of the Atlantic, or at least you don't see it in North America all that much. You might see it in Mexico, you know, given the fact that there's a lot of South American influence there. But yeah, you know, good times for San Jose at the moment. You know, but they'll be the first ones to tell you that, you know, they don't want to get too high.
Let's take a look back at sort of the season and how we got here, because I think the path to this is fascinating and I'm not sure I fully understand it. San Jose Earthquakes win in air quotes here, the wooden spoon last season, obviously massive changes, in the front office, but not a lot of changes as far as the roster personnel are concerned. Matias Almeida comes in off of, you know, his success, you know, in all, with all the turmoil at Chivas de Guadalajara. He says that they're going to spend a little bit of money. So far, they haven't really done that. And then they lose the first four games in the season. There's turmoil. Potentially, Almeida's going back to Mexico. The team doesn't seem at all on the same page as far as the man marking system defensively or what they're doing offensively. They stabilize, and now, as you said, I think proving that they're going to be a contender and definitely a playoff team in the Western Conference. They're 7-1-2 in their last 10 games. That includes, you know, two wins over the LA Galaxy, who just beat LAFC. How the heck did we get here, given where this team was four games into the season?
Well, I think that, you know, they hit a point in the season where, you know, they had no choice than to really reflect on the way that they were carrying themselves. And I'm specifically talking about the players. I've talked about it time and time again, and I said it at the beginning of the season, and I've said it before. When the team was doing bad, yes, I feel like anyone who covered the team was able and had the capacity to talk about, you know, the quality within the Earthquakes locker room. It's not the best, but it's also not the poorest. They have enough talent, you know, and we're seeing that now. They have enough talent to squeeze into the playoffs. And we know this, that in this league, making playoffs isn't asking for much. You know, when half the teams in the league or nearly half the teams in the leagues make it into this single elimination tournament, you know, it's not the biggest accomplishment. Now, you know, they had an epiphany. I don't know what really happened, you know, in that locker room, but that's what Almeida does. I guess you can see it as a form of brainwashing even. You know, he really just gets into the inner linings of the human brain and, you know, of the human consciousness. And he really flips the switch somewhere in there. He's a motivator. He's a player first coach. And he feels all this with the passion that he lived with as a player. And he'll say that too, time and time again. So I think that's what really happened, is that, you know, this team had to go through that under Almeida to really come out of it. You know, they could have done it. They couldn't have done it with anyone else. This is simply just a form of art. You know, this is Almeida, you know, at his best. And, it goes to show four times in a row now that it doesn't matter what team it is, you know, what their stature is within their respective leagues. Almeida has the capability. And in this case, I'm giving almost full credit to Almeida, by the way. Because honestly, I'm of the belief that if it wasn't Almeida, you know, this team would still be in the dumps.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I definitely see what you're saying about sort of Almeida imposing his culture and his identity of what he wanted, a team that he had, I'd say, as a player and as a manager, in Argentina and certainly with Chivas, and then now with the Quakes. One thing that I'm really, really curious about, you know, you mentioned their style of play, and I'll say in the games that I've watched the Quakes, you know, the man marking that they do defensively is absolutely fantastic to watch. I'm not sure that I fully figured it out. In my credit, GBS said after the most recent Cali Clasico that he doesn't know what happened, so maybe nobody's figured them out. Talk about what the Quakes are doing defensively, and in particular, from my standpoint, I think there's an incredible value in them zagging and executing that zag when the rest of the league is trying to zig.
Well, you know, if you start really digging into Almeida's background, it doesn't really take that much to really, you know, find the treasure that's buried under his resume. And you only have to go back to the late 90s, early 2000s when Marcelo Bielsa was the coach of Argentina. You know, that's where the magic lies. That's where a lot of it is based off of Marcelo Bielsa's tactics, his defensive tactics, what he promotes his players to do. And that is to run for their life on the field. I think he said it before, you know, there's no reason for a player not to be moving on the field while the clock is ticking. And that's kind of what Matias bases this man marking system on, is that at all times players need to be in constant movement. They're floating pieces, and you know, there's really no excuse for them not to be behind the ball or not to be, you know, closing spaces and you know, surprising opponents when they first touch the ball. And that has been a huge part of their success on the field. But I think the other part too that hasn't really been talked about is their fluid attacking style. You know, it's fluid, but at the same time, it's direct and it's very ambitious, you know, like the Quakes' ambitious turnaround, you know, at the start of the season by hiring Almeida. The ambition has kind of leaked over onto the field. You know, this is a team that is very daring. And I think a player that really embodies that is one of their winter signings. And that was Cristian Espinosa. He's a player, like I said, that just really embodies what this new era is all about. It's all about moving forward. When you're up 1-0 and you can sit back, you're not even thinking about sitting back. You're not even thinking of not being on the ball. You want possession, which is a huge, huge part of Almeida's game, is possession, 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 constant movement with the ball, but forward momentum. It's all about, you know, using that impetus and just going and going and going and, you know, putting shots on frame consistently. And that's what they've done. And, you know, the statistics don't lie. The Quakes have outnumbered opponents, I think, in the last two games. It's 72-12, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it's 72-12. And this is what, you know, opponents are having to deal with. But for some reason, there are things on the web, obviously, and things that have been written throughout time that really say about this style that Almeida's playing. It's not new. It's not new, but Almeida has really done his homework, and he's really taken, you know, the most valuable assets that he's learned throughout his career. And one of those is, you know, like you said, you know, the topic of this small conversation we're having is that man marking system that is heavily influenced by Marcelo Bielsa.
I want to talk about one player who obviously is the face of the franchise in Chris Wondolowski. He starts off the season on the bench. You know, there are jokes that, you know, I was making a joke at one point that I just wanted Wando to come in and score a goal so that I could forget about the Quake season, because the only thing that was relevant was Chris Wondolowski scoring a goal and breaking Landon Donovan's all-time goal record. He comes into a game, he gets four in a row, he goes on an absolute tear, and now he's been a little bit more of a bench player. You talked a little bit about the attack. What's going on with the Quake striker situation, and where does Wando fit in that right now?
Well, Chris was awarded a goal on Saturday against Vancouver, and he's actually been starting quite a bit. He's seen the bench. He's been subbing off as of late for Danny Huzin, who a lot of people, you know, within the Earthquake circle can argue that deserves the starting role. But, you know, Wando's, he's only a goal away from 10 league goals this season. It would make it 10 seasons in a row. Obviously a league record. For 10 straight years, he scored more than 10 goals a season. It's remarkable. You know, what this player is doing at the age of 36 is beyond, anyone's imagination, to be honest. I think even beyond his, it's just really hard to get used to. You know, you have a player who really, I know I'm not saying anything new here, but he's not the flashiest. He's not the most skilled. He's not the most technical. You know, he's just all in all a poacher, you know, a killer inside of the box. And he's living through a pretty good moment right now. I was the one that when people were calling for him to be benched, I said, there's no reason to, you know, his track record shows it. There's no way that overnight, you know, Wando has suddenly lost it all. You know, there's no way that can happen. And, you know, obviously, he showed us that, you know, there's still something left in the tank. And, you know, I think, Saturday could definitely be the day that he breaks another record.
Well said. Let's talk about some of the other players who, you know, again, I'm just going back to what this team was like last year, and I'm still just amazed that effectively the same group of players and what they looked like collectively and individually under Mikel Staré, and then now what they're looking like under Matias Almeida. And in particular, you know, I've been impressed with what I've seen from Magnus Eriksson, certainly Vaco, who I think is on one of his best runs of form since coming to MLS. And I want to say it was Taylor Twellman, somebody recently, an MLS circle suggested that if Carlos Vela wasn't having the season that he was having, that Vaca would be in the MVP conversation. You know, what have you seen from the turnaround of those two? And then maybe pick out somebody else, you know, who you'd like to highlight in that aspect.
Well, you know, I think one of the main reasons why Vaca went from perennial talent in Europe with Vitesse at an early age to a 25-year-old DP in MLS, you know, with all respects, is because of his mentality. You know, here's a player that really, it's hard to say that he's a lover of the sport because he doesn't really transmit that, at least to us, the press, right? He's a very quiet, reserved guy, who boasts tremendous skill, you know, impeccable technique and skill. But it doesn't, at least from the outside, it doesn't seem like he has a great affection or connection to the game. And now he's starting to find that under Almeida. And see, and that's another sector of Almeida's, you know, arsenal is that he's able to bring the best out of these players because he has that psychological effect on them. He unites locker rooms, which was certainly what he did with this team. This locker room was completely broken and lost in 2018 under Mikel Staré. You know, no one will admit it. No one will admit it who was a part of it, but you know, I can say that, with a lot of confidence. You know, the locker room last year was atrocious. It was broken. It was the worst, probably the worst locker room that any MLS team has seen in the last couple of years. I wonder what the locker room looked like in Cincinnati a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure it was close to that, but, you know, Almeida has done wonders in bringing the best out of Vaco. And now it seems like Vaco plays with a smile. It seems like he plays with ambition. And I keep mentioning ambition, but that's really what this team is running off of. And, yeah, it's paying dividends with Vaco. Now with Magnus was definitely hurt by everything that was going on last season. He's a player that was very close to Mikel Staré, a close friend of his. So I think that was really hampering his abilities as well. It was affecting him psychologically. You know, the fact that his friend and his coach, his countryman was failing, you know, but they were both failing together. And now it seems that, you know, things have changed for him. It's been somewhat of a quiet year statistically, but you know, he's a player that a lot of the times flies under the radar. You know, he flies under the radar, but he's been really effective for this team. He's been an influential cog, you know, for the Quakes. And, just this Saturday, he was able to jot down another goal. Definitely is never going to live up to his golden boot year in Sweden, which I believe was in 2017. I think, and I'm convinced that was the best Magnus Eriksson that the world will see, but he's effective for the Quakes. He's working, under Almeida's scheme, and, you know, there's no reason for him to go elsewhere right now.
Let's look at some of the younger players on the team. Obviously, the homegrown movement, you know, hashtag player kids, is making its way around MLS in a couple of different ways. And for the longest time, the poster boy of that for the San Jose Earthquakes was Tommy Thompson, who under a number of different coaches couldn't get on the field. He's on the field now with regularity under Almeida as an outside back when normally he was kind of a wing player. And I want to say at some point somebody thought he was a number 10. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Joel. What do you make of Tommy Thompson? Oh, what?
No, yeah, you're right. You're okay. Right. They started him as being like this polyfunctional player. He can play. It's been so long. He's been in the league so long. Anyways, I'll answer that question. Just go ahead and finish what you were saying.
Yeah. So, your thoughts on the transition and the renaissance and the late renaissance of Tommy Thompson and in general, Matias Almeida's approach to playing young kids with the Gilbert Fuentes and the, Nick Limas of the world.
Look, I tweeted this out. I believe it was in March. I think it was March. It was maybe after the first game or even before the first game of the season. I said, you know, that this was it. 2019 was it for Tommy Thompson. It was either all or nothing, to be honest with you, because I don't know for how many years now, maybe 4 or 5 years, he's been in the league and there's been so much hype. You know, to Tommy Thompson, hashtag Tommy Thompson hype train. You know, people within the league, fellow colleagues really pushing him, really hyping him up. But you know, what it boils down to is that he was mismanaged by coaches who really just don't understand that aspect of the game. They don't know how to develop homegrowns. And it's no below the belt shot. Towards Dominic Kinnear, who is, you know, the one responsible, for his progress. But, you know, that's the way that I perceive it, at least. You know, this player was severely mismanaged. He was sent to Reno. He was sent to, he was sent to Reno under Mikel Stare. He was sent to Sac Republic time and time again under Dominic Kinnear. They played him as, either a left midfielder or a right midfielder in a nominal 4-4-2. They sometimes would advertise him, as you said, as a number 10. He played as a center midfielder. No one really knew what Tommy Thompson was. All they knew was that he had great dribbling abilities, that he had some great technical abilities, but that's about it. So Matias Almeida comes in and, surprising is all, he names Tommy Thompson as a starting fullback. I don't think he had ever played fullback in his professional career. I don't know if he did it in his amateur days or if he did it in college. But yeah, I mean, he's taken off. I wouldn't say he's Earthquake's best player. Not at all. I would say he's somewhere in the middle of the pack, but he can now be, I guess, regarded as, you know, an MLS player for years to come. I think he's going to get a contract, a new contract after this season. If I'm not mistaken, his contract runs out this season. Another reason why I said it's make it or break it for him at the start of 2019. So yeah, a breath of fresh air for him, new life for Tommy Thompson. He's done things well, I think. He's done things above average as a fullback. He's a player that, you know, plays both sides of the field, under Almeida. Really likes to get forward, overlaps Cristian Espinosa a whole lot. And that's another plus, right, is that he's been able to play with Cristian Espinosa all season long. And Cristian Espinosa is really not going to make you look bad, to be honest with you. So that's another positive. And definitely, you know, Almeida's arrival has benefited, obviously, the entire team, but I would say that it's benefited Tommy Thompson the most.
Well said. And then your thoughts on just general hashtag play the kids and how Almeida's approaching some of the more teenage homegrowns?
Yeah, with caution, with a lot of caution, like I said. Previous managers, you know, here in San Jose have just haven't known how to orchestrate the development of these youth players. You know, sometimes they throw them into the fire, and that's what they did with Tommy Thompson. Frankly, they were starting to do that with some of the younger guys as well. Nick Lima, they threw him into the fire, but Nick Lima's is a different breed. You know, he's quite the player. He's quite the player, to be honest with you. I see him in Europe in at least, you know, no more than 2 years. He should be in Europe. He's a different type of player with a different type of worth ethic and with a different type of skill and physicality. But, you know, there was a good chance that if Matias wasn't, you know, to be named the coach of the black and blue, that some of these other new youngsters like Gilbert Fuentes and Jacob Eckenridge, as well as Kate Cowell, would have experienced something similar to what Tommy Thompson experienced. So, like I said, Matias is now, obviously he has a tremendous, tremendous experience with youngsters. Over at Chivas, he handled the team from the bottom to the top. In 2017, he won the League Cup. He won two cups. Sorry. He won a domestic tournament and the League Cup. And he also made Chivas U20 champions. And that's because he oversees, you know, the U20s. He was overseeing the youngsters, the academies, as well as the first team, obviously. And he makes sure that, you know, all of these different age groups, you know, run with the same methodology, that they run with similar tactics, maybe not ideal, obviously, because Matias can't be, you know, coaching both or three or four sides, but, you know, he really orchestrates everything with the youth coaches and just makes sure that there's a lot of fluidity all across the board. And that's what he's doing with San Jose, at least to my understanding, is that he's really overseeing the academy. He has youngsters train with the first team every Wednesday. You know, I'm talking like 20 youngsters, 20 academy prospects train with the first team. That's a big deal. You know, that doesn't really happen everywhere else in this league. So there's a huge emphasis on the youth side, and mostly because, obviously, as we know, the Bay Area is a hotbed for talent. So they're going to take advantage of that, but they're going to take it slow. You know, we saw Kate Cowell at the beginning of the season score against Monterrey, you know, in a friendly. That's not an easy thing to do. But what did Almeida say right after that? He said that you guys probably aren't going to see this player for another 6 months. You know, I'm going to keep him under the radar, maybe send him to Reno and slowly work on his development. It's about patience. It's about knowing which avenues to take. It's not about throwing, you know, players into the fire. So, you know, in that case, you know, the Quakes are in good hands. And I think, the hashtag player kids movement here in San Jose is definitely going to pay dividends in the future.
Well said, Joel. Let's talk about home form, because obviously this game will be taking place at Avaya Stadium in San Jose. The Quakes are 7-3-1, I believe, in home form in regular season play in 2018. They lost their first three home games during that really bad start that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation. And then the only game that they haven't won since then was a 2-2 draw back on June 8th against FC Dallas. They've won every single other game, at Avaya that's played, and then obviously they had that big win in the Cali Clasico at Sanford Stadium against the LA Galaxy. Is Avaya becoming a fortress for the Quakes right now?
It's a castle. it's Avaya Castle. It's definitely living up to its billing. Yeah, it's nearly impossible to beat this team right now in San Jose. It really is. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, with the fact that these players are animated, you know, to play in front of the home crowd. It seems like keeping them away for a week or two makes them have like withdrawals. You know, they come back and, you know, they're just up on their feet and they're really feeding off the crowd and the crowd is feeding off of them. The stadium still needs to fill up. That's another topic of conversation that I haven't talked about that I've been wanting to talk about. I guess I'll talk about it a little bit here very quickly. You know, this team has lacked in that department. They haven't been able to get people fill, you know, the seats of the stadium. And that needs to change because the team has certainly already turned a corner, actually turned two corners and is about to, you know, make a lap around the neighborhood. This team is unrecognizable till it was in 2018. And, you know, they're somewhat appealing now to the Latino community here in San Jose too. So I don't see why, you know, why the stadium shouldn't fill up. But it's going to be a difficult task for Colorado, I tell you. And I think you and everyone else is very aware of that. It's definitely the toughest thing to do, in MLS at the moment. At least I think it is. And that is beating the San Jose Earthquakes out of Valle Stadium.
Fair said, Joel. I guess with that, let's get to our final big question that I have for you. What do you see happening in this game? If you're feeling, you know, feel free to give a prediction if you want. I'm not holding you to it. And then you mentioned a little bit earlier that maybe, you know, set pieces could be critical, for, the Colorado Rapids. Do you see any, you just said that you don't think anybody can beat the San Jose Earthquakes right now. If you were talking to Connor Casey, and I'm not saying that he listens to this podcast, you know, what would you recommend? How does an opponent go into Avaya and go about attacking the Quakes right now?
Well, I think he needs to understand that he's not going to see the ball and that he has to feel comfortable with his team being on their back foot all 90 minutes. I'm not a fan of predictions. I've never given predictions and I don't think I ever will. At least not in terms of final scores, but I will give one prediction and that is possession. I think the Quakes will definitely warrant at least 70% of the possession, this weekend, without a doubt. I don't think the Rapids will see the ball much, but they didn't see the ball much against LAFC either. And they were able to squeeze out a 1-0, victory. Now, the thing is that Colorado is traveling to San Jose, and that's where things really get tricky and complicated. They're going to have to take advantage of their set pieces. Like I said, you know, they have, Tommy Smith, who I think has, great aerial abilities. Abubakar as well. So, you know, the Quakes, the one, I guess, vulnerability that they've shown this season is that they can't really defend set pieces, whether it's a throw in, whether it's, you know, a free kick, whether it's a corner kick, you know, they're a little shaky on that end. And I think, I don't know, I don't watch the Rapids religiously and I think I'm excused, you know, but, I think that's one of their, maybe you can correct me on this, but I think that's one of their strengths, don't you think? Their set pieces, they're a little stronger on that end. They have Kai Kamara in the box as well. He didn't play last game. I know that. So, but I think that's going to be it for Connor Casey. He's going to have to make sure that his team is compact, that, you know, they're not really playing out of transitions because if they're trying to push up and they get caught off guard, you know, this team is really going to make them pay for it. Then at the same time, if they want to play from the back, which I really highly doubt they will, they're going to get suffocated, due to, you know, the Quakes on and off high pressing, scheme. So I don't know. It's a world of complications. And I, you know, if Connor's listening, I really don't know what else to say. It's just buckle up and hope that Tim Howard and the defense is able to, keep the Quakes at bay.
No, I agree with you, Joel. It's definitely going to be a tough task for the Pids. Just a few notes that our listeners will be aware of, but you know, Kai Kamara still dealing with a little bit of an injury. He's questionable, and then Tim Howard actually had to be subbed out at halftime just after the game tied up, and Sebastian Anderson got his red card for a questionable calf injury. Right now, he's listed as day-to-day, so you know, by the time this podcast comes out, we might have a better understanding about whether or not he's training with the club right now. But Connor Casey's been pretty consistent in the team being very sound defensively, letting the opponent, even when they come into DSG, have the ball and try to break out and do stuff in transition. So I'm really curious to see what a Jonathan Lewis or a Sam Nicholson does against that man marking of the San Jose Earthquakes. But I agree with you that I think the best chance for the Rapids to try and get something, you know, maybe smash and grab or, you know, get out of there with a 1-1 draw is probably going to be trying to create something on a set piece. And that's going to be Abubakar or Tommy Smith or, you know, maybe a hopefully healed Kai Kamara. But that's all that we had as far as the main stuff that I wanted to talk about. Joel, listeners, if you like what Joel said today and want to hear more, again, check him out at Saria Joel Football on Twitter. And then, of course, Words at Quakes Epicenter and YouTube stuff at Black and Azul. Joel, I'll give you the last word on the segment. Any other closing thoughts on anything, or shall we get out of here?
Well, I think you guys now know that I don't follow the Rapids religiously.
Yeah. All right. Listeners, we are back. Me and Mark will be wrapping up the show with Ask HTHL. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. Thank you to Joel Soria for being our guest this week. Mark, any closing thoughts or predictions you have on this match between the Colorado Rapids and the man-marking absolute head case that is Matias Almeida?
We are 3 games without a win right now for the Rapids, and I feel pretty confident that it's likely to be a 4th. This is a team that just turned it around 100%. Last year, they were hot garbage on a stick, San Jose. They started the first 4 or 5 games of the season hot garbage again, and then it all clicked. The team just seemed to figure out how to mark, and those guys in the middle, Erickson and Vaco, they just kind of started to work it out. And Danny Huysen, never sure how to pronounce it.
I think it's Huysen.
It's probably Huysen. But yeah, this is going to be a tough game. It's on the road. San Jose has been a hot team. You know, I'm picking 3-1 San Jose in this game.
I'm picking 2-0 the San Jose, with probably them jogging out the last 20 to 25 minutes or so. And I'll put an extra condition on there that if it ends up being that Kai Kamara is again not available for this game at all, I think it'll be 3-0 comfortably for them. I don't know how you go about marking this team. I don't know how you beat this team in Avaya. And really, you know, the Rapids have one offensive option, and that's Jonathan Lewis. And if somebody does a good number on him defensively, I don't see the Rapids getting anything from it. And I also see them having not a lot of possession against a team that's just going to bear down them with a whole bunch of offensive weapons. All right, Mark, we got a bunch.
Matt, is that the Rapids play them again on August 10th. So that,
yeah, 2 weeks.
Yeah, so if they don't get a handle on this game, maybe they'll learn something and be able to take it into the next meeting.
All right, Mark, let's get to Ask HTHL. We've got 3 coming in this week, and they're all really good ones. Our first one comes from David Malenfant. And David asks, was commenting on watching, first of all, seeing Hartford Athletic, and he's a Connecticut native, so he's really, really happy to see them. But he was watching them, Mark, because guess who with Sporting Kansas City was a big trade involving the Rapids and is currently with Swope Park Rangers?
Well, it can't be Benny Fellhaber. Who is it?
It's Kellen Rowe.
Kellen Rowe, that's right.
Okay, so Mark, you had the trade in the offseason where the Rapids sent the rights to Edgar Castillo, MLS rights to Edgar Castillo, to New England Revolution, based on some rough reporting we got that it ended up being that New England paid the transfer fee to Monterey in order to acquire Edgar Castillo's, I guess, international rights, so to speak. In return for that, New England sends Kellen Rowe to the Colorado Rapids, who they then immediately flip for Benny Fellhaber to Sporting Kansas City. Now, Benny Fellhaber did not do a whole lot for the Rapids in this one, but effectively the Rapids getting out of, getting a little bit more flexibility. You know, there were some questions about whether or not they were going to be okay at the left back position. Did not have to play a multi-million dollar transfer fee, and Zam Vines is playing at the left back position and is generally doing okay. And Kellen Rowe, who everybody was like, well, what are you doing, Rapids? Why aren't you keeping Kellen Rowe, so to speak? You know, or excuse me, no, it wasn't Benny Fellhaber they traded for. They got Diego Rubio. So Diego Rubio has had some good moments. Zam Vines is filling in that void that Edgar Castillo leaves. Edgar Castillo is playing well, but is still on the wrong side of 30 and playing on turf. And Kellen Rowe is playing in in USL. Should we be giving Porik or the Rapids in general a little bit more credit given this trade and how it was initially received?
I think so, but I don't think it's so much about the fact that Kellen Rowe didn't work out so much as Edgar Castillo was going to walk for nothing, or you were going to have to – the Rapids knew that they were – or everyone in the league knew that the Rapids were in a hot – in a hard place, that they did not want to pay the money for this player. They probably weren't going to be a playoff contending team, or if they were – Edgar Castillo wasn't a long-term solution. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, does Edgar Castillo get you into the playoffs? Maybe. Did the Rapids construct themselves for 2019 to be in a position to win MLS Cup? No. And Edgar Castillo's on the wrong side of 30 to be able to help you 2 years from now. So he wasn't really a good solution for them all around. It wasn't a good use of money to go and buy him outright from Monterrey. So it'd be better for the Rapids to flip him, and anything they could get in return would be a good move. So getting Diego Rubio is a good thing. I don't know about, you know, the prognostication of Kellen Rowe and turning and knowing that he wasn't going to turn into something. I think the other thing that always amazes me, which is I'm going to sound really stupid because I'm a pretty smart guy and I study Talmud for a living, but I'm always amazed at the ability to work a three-team trade. I always find three-team trades to be really confusing. Like, it's like, so-and-so got this, and so-and-so got this, and so-and-so got this. And I'm like, wait, what happened? Why did those guys take that? Why did those guys – like, I get it. Like, I get that, like, you know, everybody's got something that the other guy wants, and so they do this little, like, you know, Mexican standoff round robin thingy. But, like, I am always amazed that somebody, A, can theorize it and get everyone to agree to it, and B, that everybody can make the mechanics work.
Well said, Mark. We'll move on to our second one. This one comes from Eric Jansen. We'll get to his pronunciation of his last name in a little bit. So, Mark, Eric is a season ticket holder. He got the early opportunity to buy tickets for the Arsenal friendly and took a couple of his Euro snob friends, three of them. Two were Arsenal supporters, and one of them was a Man U fan. One of the Arsenal supporters is originally from London, and he has Arsenal supporters going back generations in his family. They go to the game, they end up having an absolute blast, and it was an epic night for them. The Arsenal fans got to stay around and take pictures with the players, and apparently they ran into the Arsenal fan TV folks as well, so epic night for them. But so in any case, Mark, one of the Arsenal fans, only player he knew on the Rapids going into this match was Tim Howard, and he's watching the game, and he says, who's number 10? He has quality. So, of course, Eric explains that he's Kellen Acosta and everything. Apparently Acosta was hanging out in 1876 after the match as well, was taking pictures and signing autographs. So Kellen Acosta is a good guy. But so it didn't take much to stand out with this specific Rapids team. But now, you know, we're coming up on one full calendar year from the Kellen Acosta trade. Sending Don Baggi to FC Dallas and swapping a few other assets. Where do you think he stands at? Eric thinks that the jury is still out and that the coaching change is probably a bit of a factor, but he's not disappearing in ways that we saw him disappear in matches at the end of last season, or I would even say at the beginning of this season as well. And then on the other side, he's a young star. He's a player who the Rapids acquired and said immediately, you know, U.S. men's national team international, Kellen Acosta joins the Rapids. And I think there's a general consensus consensus that, you know, he, you know, if it was a 35-man roster for a World Cup had to come out today, Greg Berhalter doesn't have Kellen Acosta on there. And then Eric ended the email with saying that it's the regular J in Jansen. Last time he emailed in, I had some questions about it, and apparently it is pronounced Jansen for his relatives in Sweden. So, Eric, I guess you win the Axel Schuberg pronunciation of the month award for holding the high line. But, Mark, what's your take now that we have a year's worth of data on Kellen Acosta with the Rapids and who ended up winning that trade?
Boy, that's really a good question. I feel like Porik Smith pretty much got the idea here, which was that a lot of people thought that Dominic Baggi was a young stud who was really gonna, you know, explode and do a lot more with a better team. And I feel like that thesis has been proven to be untrue. Right now, Baggi has 6 goals in 2019. He had 2 goals with Dallas in 2018 after 7 goals with the Rapids. I mean, he's just he's like Tesho Akindele in the sense that he's a solid but unspectacular striker. He has some physical talents which are exceptional. But he doesn't have, you know, we make fun of Jazzy Zardes' first touch. I think he also has some first touch issues. He's not big on passing, so he can't do a whole lot of other things for you, unless the other striker is alongside him in the box. And he's not a shooter finisher type. You know, he's not, his accuracy from distance and even from close up isn't above average. So I spend a lot of time talking about Acosta by talking about Baggi. Acosta still has upside. I still think he has some growth to do. I think the challenge with Acosta has to do with system and formation more than anything, which is almost always the case with central midfielders. Central midfielders are extremely beholden to how everybody else plays. This is an article by itself, maybe for American Soccer Analysis down the road, if I wanted to get back into soccer writing. But, just asking the question of like, how much linkage does he provide? How much defense does he provide? How much does he break up the opposing team's play? How much does he contribute to, the pass before the pass? So I think those are the really important questions with Acosta. I feel like he's shown sparks, but it hasn't always been – every game is not always exceptional. I still think he's like maybe operating at 85% of where he ought to be. Like I think he's a 15-10 guy or a 10-15 guy, but right now he's really not producing at that level. He's more producing at like an 8-8 kind of level, which means, you know, he's peak – Dylan Powers, as opposed to, you know, peak Andrea Pirlo or peak Nico Lodero, like, mm-hmm. which is what you really want to see out of him.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Mark. I agree that I think what we saw from Baggi and, you know, his last season with the Rapids and what we've seen from him since with FC Dallas, I think bears out the trajectory of his career. He is an average striker, and if you need a budget option to come off the bench or be a second forward with your DP or your big signing, that he's gonna be fine. But, you know, take away Joseph Martinez and put Dom Baggi on, you know, Atlanta United's team last year. Yes, Baggi finally gets to that 10-goal objective that he's set for himself and come up short on, you know, the last 3 or 4 seasons. But, you know, maybe he gets like 14 goals and 5 assists, and a lot of them are tap-ins, and maybe he's taking PKs. But then Atlanta fans are probably talking about a few of the misses that he has against a game against DC United or the New York Red Bulls or in a playoffs or an Open Cup semifinal, for example. And he's immediately his position is the first one that Atlanta's thinking, that's where we're going with our next DP striker. And there's nothing wrong with that, just as much as, you know, Jack McBean was, you know, peaked out as being an above average striker in the USL. I think there's plenty of room for guys like Dom Baggi in MLS to be productive players, to contribute to their team, to compete in the playoffs and have a chance to win, you know, maybe one or two trophy, have one or two good opportunities to win a trophy over the course of, you know, a 10 to 15 year career, so to speak. But, you know, Bodgy wasn't going to do anything more than he was going to do for the Rapids. And for the Rapids to improve, they needed to change the team and then thus change what their strikers were doing and thus change their personnel in the form of Bodgy. I agree with Eric's assessment in the sense that I think Acosta has definitely improved in the last 12 months. I think he's fading out of games a lot less than we saw from him at the end of last season. And certainly, you know, in terms of that being the main thing that Dallas fans complained about him as a central midfielder in Dallas, I think he's not doing that as much. He's more consistent, but I agree with you, Mark. The offensive contributions, aren't there. You know, if and when the Rapids sign their next two DPs, I don't think Kellen Acosta should be wearing the number 10 shirt as much as maybe that is his favorite number, or maybe stroking his ego or indicative of the fact that he thinks he's a big contributor. But we saw him at times as the number 10 at the top of the diamond in the 4-4-2, and it did not always look successful. I just don't think he has that creative attacking flair, or he's a good enough on the ball or a good of enough finisher in terms of either creating his own shot or creating shots for other people. He is the pass before the pass that ultimately opens things up. And in that, I think, you know, I guess one thing we'll give credit to Anthony Hudson in this one, as Hudson was one of the ones who moved him back when there was a bit of a formation shift, and that's where Connor Casey's been playing him almost exclusively. And I think Kellen's peak out at this point is as a more offensive number 8 in, say, a flat 4-4-2, or the offensive player in a double pivot. You know, I think he'd be a fantastic player in terms of what he could do from a skill set standpoint, and like a 4-3-3 if he was one of the most central guys. I wouldn't be terrified about the U.S. men's national team, for example, if Greg Berhalter was playing a 4-3-3 with Acosta, you know, it's like Christian Pulisic out wide, so in the front three, and then Weston McKennie and Tyler Adams. I think those three are similar enough to where they could all do similar things. Acosta, to be fair, hasn't been at that level, but I think that's his best position. I think that's the position where he's going to have the most success in MLS. Can, you know, he's been consistently good. Can he up that in a few moments where maybe he needs to be, you know, to where we would have seen, you know, from, you know, a Tyler Adams would have done that, or, you know, Darlington Nagbe at times in the playoffs, maybe, you know, but where we would have seen, you know, somebody of just a higher caliber, like a Jonathan Osorio, for example. You know, I still think that final little bit hasn't really gotten there from him. He's gotten out a lot of the cobwebs from him at Dallas, but, you know, he's in like the 80th percentile. So, okay, you're a solid B, you're above average, you know, you're quality. Can you get to that time where a few times in a match you're an A minus and really making a contributing play that's going to change the game? I still think is missing from Kellen Acosta, and whether or not he has that, I'm not really sure. And, you know, I'm still not sure with what he's giving the team right now that his salary pump that he's getting, where on targeted allocation money he's going to be making about $800,000, you know, as a base salary in 2020. I don't know that that's warranted, and that number might have been based on the expectation, both from a quality standpoint and a marketing standpoint, that they were going to say that, you know, he was a regularly getting called up to the United States men's national team. So for a guy who's a solid contributor on your team but on the outskirts of the national team, I think there's clearly something missing in terms of what his game that he could improve upon. And in that, I'm concerned a little bit about the money that they're making. I'm still way more concerned about what the Rapids are doing with a Danny Wilson and a Tommy Smith contract and what they're doing from a DP standpoint. But if it gets to the point where the Rapids are, you know, just so one more key signing away from making the playoffs and they need an extra $100K to $200K in targeted allocation money, I might be looking at that Kellen Acosta contract a little bit differently. If he gets to the point where he's that A-minus player, I have absolutely no complaints about where he's playing or how he's playing, independent of what Greg Berhalter thinks about him at the next level.
One last thing. Acosta, there are three numbers I think are important to throw out about Acosta. The first two are about this year. He has one goal and two assists this year, which it just feels like there should be more out of a guy who wears the number 10, even if he really plays like a number 6 or a number 8 for your team. The other number that's important to remember is 23. That's how old Kellen Acosta is. 23 is still pretty young for a soccer player. He turns 24 in just a couple of days. But the reality is, actually, let me take that back. He turns 24 tomorrow, Matthew.
By the time you are listening to this, folks, happy birthday, Kellen Acosta.
Happy birthday, Kellen Acosta. But so we'll see that from Richard Fleming for sure on the Twitters. But so he's still young. I still think he's got two or three more years to kind of turn into something greater than what he is. But I think right now, Acosta is more or less what we see, which is he's a pretty decent defender, but not an exceptional one. He's an okay connector, but he's not a big offensive threat for the team. You know, back to what I said about 8-8, I'd be happy to get 5-5 out of Acosta, and maybe move him over to becoming more of a role playing, sometimes midfielder than the critical, element for your entire offense.
I think that's probably fair, Mark. You know, I think 5-5, you know, that's what I would have expected, you know, out of a Russell Knauss, for example, with DC United, or a Jackson Ewell, who will be playing against the Rapids with San Jose Earthquakes on Saturday. And I think that's a fair comparison in terms of role and style of play for Kellen Acosta. I would hope at some point that he gets, given the salary, that he gets to a quality level above those two. And then our last guest, Ask HTHL, Mark, will close out the show, with Peter South, who asks, the consistency in the referee decisions within MLS by pro referees varies greatly throughout the season, within the week, and games. Examples of similar plays with different calls or are reversed. The Rapids seem to be experiencing this more. What can be done to fix this? I'll preface this, Mark, where Peter and I were going a little back and forth on Twitter, and he called up the question of, you know, is if Sebastian Anderson's foul on Saturday is a red card, what about the Justin Glad slide tackle, you know, where the bottom of his studs almost go into the ankle of Kellen Acosta? And then also Keegan Rosenberry commented when I asked him about Seb Anderson's performance on Saturday, you know, saying, I've seen way worse things. Only been given a yellow. I've seen the exact same play get called even, and I think that's pretty fair. That's a fair criticism of pro. Where pretty regularly we see calls that absolutely change a game or could have changed a game, and I see that exact foul, and I'm like, I've seen that been called a yellow. I've seen that been called a red. I've seen worse things been not called a foul. I've seen less things been. I've seen players get sent off for less. Mark, your thoughts on Peter's questions regarding fixing the inconsistencies within reffing in Major League Soccer.
This is going to be a controversial statement. I feel like the inconsistencies in Major League Soccer are not a problem of pro referees or Major League Soccer so much as they are endemic to the practice of refereeing nationwide, worldwide, that you will just see a variety of different slide tackles with a variety of different angle flexion, force, you know, angle of approach, point at which the players collide with the ball, and they will be called differently. That what to one referee is a foul and to another referee is a red card, and there's no way around it. It's just part of the nature of the game. I am happy that we have VAR, that there's the ability to kind of review it. I think it's weird to have a situation where the fourth official says, no, I think I like your call. You don't need to review it on video. Like that's always an interesting thing. Or to say, let's look it on the camera so that we can be extra right and then say that we looked at it. Like VAR adds an interesting wrinkle to it. You know, I think there's a great, the last thing I'll say is this. It would be really valuable for anyone who's super interested in this to follow a guy on Twitter by the name of MLS Ref Stats.
Yes.
He just provides you with the number and percentage of yellows and reds that a ref generally doles out each game. So you can kind of see who's on the high end and who's on the low end. So, you know, if you really are fundamentally believing that there are certain refs who are just willy-nilly with cards, or who are really tough on your team, it's worth checking this out and seeing, like, does it bear scrutiny?
Well said, Mark. I think that there's starting to be a generational gap in terms of MLS referees. And as you know, every couple of years, FIFA comes out, or even MLS at the MLS level, they'll come out and they'll either change a rule or change their interpretation of things. You know, the last time or two times ago when MLS was looking at stuff, they really wanted to crack down on mass confrontation, where if there's a third player who's coming into a pile to go after a referee, then that player and everybody after them is going to be given a yellow card. We've seen MLS and Pro, to their credit for me, crack down on dissent a lot. I think there are ways to have a constructive conversation with the official, and there are ways to abuse the official. And I think that professional athletes should be held to a higher standard in terms of level of profanity or putting their hands on the official. Sometimes I think those can get a little bit, out of whack there. You know, you saw the red card to Albert Elise, 10 minutes in, when Houston Dynamo was at Atlanta the other day, I thought was completely out of whack on that. But that's something to where I think we'd be a healthier as a soccer nation if every single player just said, like, I'm not going to threaten violence or, say something that involves profanity that is going to immediately insult the character or the intelligence of the official. And I'm not going to do anything to where the official is going to think that I'm physically going to harm him. And so in that, I agree with Pro's decision to crack down on things like dissent and mass confrontation. I think there are a lot of things that they're going at, whether it's the introduction of VAR, how they're choosing about calling red cards, how they're implementing VAR, or even PKs, for example, and violent conduct and red cards, to where there's a lot of the old guard, the Mark Geigers of the world, the Baldomero Toledos of the world, to where they're still calling things differently. The game of soccer at an international level and at an MLS level was very different in terms of how it was called and the level of physicality and what was a red card and what was a yellow card than what they are playing in right now. I've sat back up in that press box talking with a number of different people, and at one point I want a player's opinion, and of course Marcelo Balboa is hanging out there. I'd ask him about a particular play, what'd you think, and Marcelo would say, back when I was playing, players did that, like that happened five times a game and it never got called, right? So I think there's a lot of refs on the older end. You saw with Howard Webb's retirement, for example, to where they're stuck in their old ways and they're used to a particular type of play, and then in that you have inconsistency from week to week within the individuals. I would like to see MLS come out and even, not violating the rules of the game, so to speak, but have clear, distinct interpretations like they did with dissent and with mass confrontation. We've talked about handball so much on this show this week about, where is it as far as intent? Was his hand in an unnatural position? Was it ball to hand or hand to ball? How much time did he have in terms of space and reaction and the redirection of the play? I'd love for MLS to come out there and just simplify something or have a real consistent of, this is our approach in how we are teaching officials for how to interpret games and these sorts of situations, and we're going to be consistent in that, and it might not be how other leagues are going to call it, but every single ref is going to approach it from that same procedural mindset and interpretation of different aspects of the language or what they would consider where's a red line versus not, so to speak. And I would like to see MLS do that a little bit more consistently. Obviously, we don't have as much complaints, as far as stuff that's considered endangering the safety of the opponent, but I do think the league could sharpen up a little bit across the generational gap of referees as far as what they consider a level of force. Does it count if the studs were kind of coming up, but then he didn't come in with studs, point of contact, and I think having pool reporters and questions like this to where we get to get inside the mind of what they were thinking, I think would be healthy. I almost think it would be healthy for every single week Pro to just issue like a blanket press release with what any critical decision, any PK, any goal that was called back, and any red card that was called, what their thought process was behind it. And so we could at least, maybe secretly they have a big thought process that just isn't publicly known about how they judge different things with red card and in red cards and intent and point of contact and how much force and, were they trying to play the ball and where was the ball, and maybe we're just not seeing that. And people like you and me, we have to bang on doors and go through the pool reporter question just to get an inkling of information on them, and they want to give us as little as possible. I think it would be more helpful for them to be a little bit more transparent and explain their decisions. Maybe there's a method to the madness. I don't think there is. We'll see whether or not Baldomero Toledo has that on Saturday. Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at @LWSMattPollard. Check out my writing at lastwordonsoccer.com. And if you're super into, if you want to have a crazy soccer Saturday and see a bunch of stuff on the USL, I guess check out Mark's work at Pittsburgh Soccer Now. Rapids 96 Podcast on the Twitterverse, rapids96podcast@gmail.com. Thank you to our three Ask HTHLs, patreon.com/rapids96podcast. With that, Mark, we'll see you next week, folks.
Peace.